Mick Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
We're living through some pretty extraordinary climate times. There's not much doubt about that at all. But humans have lived through some very dramatic climate changes before. The 17th century's Little Ice Age is one such period. From the late 1500s to the early 1700s, temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere plunged by an average of 2 degrees Celsius. It might not sound like much, but the ramifications were huge. Shorter growing seasons and long icy winters, to say the least. German historian Philip Blom argues that the Little Ice Age also had a huge impact on Western culture. He joins me now. Hello, Philip.
Hello there.
What did this Little Ice Age look like? Can you paint a visual picture for us?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, like all climate change, like we are experiencing today, but of course it's getting warmer today, but it was a period of extreme weather events. It wasn't so much that everything became a little bit colder, but the weather was becoming more extreme. That meant that on the Thames, on the River Thames in London, you had frost fairs where there were whole little wooden cities built on the ice. Whole armies could ride across the River Danube. Mediterranean ports, which are usually very warm, were frozen solid up to springtime sometimes. So that was big change. And of course, that also meant that very often you had shorter, rainy, cool, lightless summers, and the grain simply wouldn't ripen in the fields and people went hungry. So it was a time that really had some very extreme effects on people. Incidentally, that Little Ice Age didn't just apply in Europe. It probably also made itself felt in Australia. It's just that my research was really focused on Europe because we've got the best data sets on Europe.
It's interesting you mentioned frost fairs. I wasn't aware of that until recently. The Thames in London, which we now know is a very fast-flowing, heavy river, it really was covered over completely, wasn't it? And a whole new part of the city was built up on these frozen areas.
That's right. You could have everything from taverns to brothels to printing shops where you could buy souvenir printed sheets that you had been there in the frost fair. So tourism and entrepreneurship will always win out in some way or another. But at the same time, of course, it led to a very profound crisis. It led to a profound crisis of agriculture and on a continent where people ate local food and basically lived off subsistence agriculture. Once that broke down, everything broke down. And while the people in the countryside went hungry because they had no grain, the people in the cities went hungry because the grain prices went up, because supplies, of course, were dwindling. And so they had galloping inflation, and that in turn led to social unrest. For instance, if you look at, you know, Shakespeare, we know him for having coined the phrase, "This is the winter of our discontent." Well, perhaps he meant more by that than just a speech by an English king. When he was writing his drama Coriolanus, which is set in ancient Rome, Coriolanus, the drama, starts off with a bread riot because people could no longer afford the bread prices. And as Shakespeare was writing this piece in 1608 in the winter, there were bread riots in London. So he literally put topical politics on the stage.
So that's how it impacted people's daily life, this miniature ice age. How did it transform the social and political fabric of Europe?
You know, that's a little bit more tenuous, but I think you can draw a pretty convincing connection. First of all, you know, how did people react to this climate change? Well, they reacted like medieval people would have reacted. So they thought if the harvests don't come in, that's a punishment by God because we've been bad. So they had special church services. They had pilgrimages. They carried crucifixes up glaciers, which were getting bigger. And they always, after bad harvests, there was a whole, literally, witch hunts. There were trials of witches, and people were being burnt at the stake because they were accused of having spoiled the harvests. But after a few years and indeed decades of that, it became pretty obvious that none of that was changing the weather. And slowly and by trial and error, people tried other solutions. One of them was that botanists, for the first time, looked empirically, how can we make plants grow better? How can we improve agriculture? Which new crops can we plant that are perhaps less sensitive to bad weather, such as, for instance, potatoes, which had come, of course, from America? So there was a certain empirical move towards understanding nature better. It's also the first time that we have weather diaries where people simply wrote down what the weather had been like, because if nature becomes so weird, then it attracts more attention. People look more closely. Yeah. So the world became, in a way, more empirically minded. And another thing that was very important mechanism for making good the shortfalls of grain in certain regions where the weather had been bad, the harvests had been bad, was trade.
Right.
Trade became more internationalized. Trade became internationalized throughout Europe, not just for luxury goods, but also for basic staples such as grain. You know, that strengthened markets, and markets mean that you need people who can read and write and count. You basically need middle-class people. And markets also give you a different approach to society because it's a more pragmatic, more tolerant approach. If you make a contract with someone, you're not really interested in whether that person is Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or gay or straight. What you want to know is that person going to honor his contract?
Yeah.
So it was a sort of constant influencing factor, a constant pressure to one side of change. And eventually that resulted in the fact that these people who were bringing the new ideas to the world, who were the botanists, who were the professors, who were the traders, the lawyers, the doctors, the middle-class people, they became much more stronger in European cities, and they also wanted the share of political power. Now, they had obviously a lot of economic power. They had some cultural power because they were patrons of the arts, many of them, but they had very little political power. And if you want political power, ask any politicians, you need to be able to argue it. You need to be able to argue why you should have it. What they said was, don't we all have the same right to fashion and shape our lives and to pursue our happiness? These arguments pop up first in the trading cities of Europe in the late 17th century, and from people like Spinoza and Descartes and Thomas Hobbes and so, all centered in these trading cities and all members of that middle class. And that is the beginning of what we call now today the Enlightenment.
Of course. Oh, this is fascinating. We're with Philip Blom, who's the author of a book called Nature's Mutiny, How the Little Ice Age of the Long 17th Century Transformed the West and Shaped the Present. In that regard, you could say that all of this gave rise to things like capitalism, the development of cities, education. Would that be correct?
Well, you know, you have to be careful not to say it got 2 degrees colder and therefore we had the Enlightenment. But
it's a long bow, but you can point us towards
it. It's a long bow, but actually you can make it because subsistence agriculture, which was the medieval model of countryside living, proved to be pretty inefficient in dealing with that. So what happened was that the landlords chased away a lot of people from their land and unified those lands and began producing agricultural produce for a market. You can actually demonstrate that the place was becoming more capitalist, more market-oriented, more empirical. Now, were all those things good changes? Well, that depends very much on your vision. For instance, this is also the time of the first economists writing. They were called the mercantilists back then. And they gave their kings a pretty simple piece of advice because, you know, everybody was involved in a war with someone. And so the kings needed a lot of money. Wars are very expensive. And they said, well, you can only do that if you basically export more than you import. You keep growing. And what do you do to get that growth? Well, you need to exploit someone. You've got your own poor people, and they will provide cheap labor. If you have colonies, you can use your colonial peoples for even cheaper labor. And of course, you have natural resources to exploit. So the idea of economic growth based on exploitation really comes from that time. And that was the sort of secret recipe for European greatness for 400 years. And now, of course, it's becoming an existential threat for the world because we are beginning to understand that there isn't much more to exploit, or that exploitation, especially of fossil fuels, has side effects that are becoming so dramatic that we really can't continue doing that.
Well, can we talk about that, the impact of this miniature ice age? What is the impact of it in this current day, mainly perhaps through culture, through the economy, through art?
The impact today, I mean, when you say art, I immediately think of the beautiful winter landscapes painted back then. And, you know, winter was discovered then as a subject of art because obviously the winters were so much more severe that people noticed and people wanted that reflected also in how they looked at the world, for instance, through paintings. But you know, when the ice age finally waned, the European continent had changed. It was no longer a feudal continent, a basically late medieval one, but it was an early capitalist one. It had created a model of economy that was very, very successful, that had developed a scientific method that allowed us to get a much better grip on reality, on the physical world. But also, It had really refined the system of exploitation. I'm always interested in history, not only because it's stuff that happened, but because it gives us a better handle on understanding ourselves today. You know, we are the heirs to this phenomenon. We are the heirs to this idea of economic growth based on exploitation. But we're also the heirs of the ideas of the Enlightenment that accompanied that. You know, that might just give us a little edge in our knowledge of the present, because we are again in a period of climate change, and this time we can be pretty sure that it's man-made climate change. Look, I wrote this book as a case study of what happens to a society when the climate changes, what changes in a society, and the answer is pretty much everything. You know, a feudal medieval continent became an early modern capitalist continent. So by implication, I think we should be aware that we are in for very big changes today, because obviously our economic system can't remain what it is, because otherwise we're simply going to choke. If the economy changes, well, our political systems may be next. Our cultural understanding may have to move towards seeing ourselves more as one organism among many on this planet. Actually, this planet doesn't need us. We need this planet.
Yeah.
If we want to be able to continue to live here, we may have to find our place within nature, not think that we are standing outside of it.
So
again, you see, the changes that are brought on by this are vast and encompass every area of life.
Just one final question, Philip, talking about the mini ice age again and what we can learn from it. I imagine that a mini ice age would have impacted on human migration. Can you tell me what impact that had on culture? Because I feel like we will probably face and are already facing a similar situation.
Well, today I think that situation will be much more severe. It's funny that you mentioned that, because in the 17th century, in the late 16th and 17th, you had massive migration into the cities, partly because of the landless peasants who had been chased away. They needed to go somewhere. So people moved into the cities, but the cities didn't grow in size. Now, what happened to all those people? Where did they vanish? Very simple. Migrants live in the dirtiest, cheapest parts of town. You had regular epidemics and all kinds of illness. So they were very vulnerable to early death. And also because they had very little money, they married late and had fewer children. You know, the cities did not actually grow, but effectively, you know, as somebody later said in the 19th century, the city eats its children. But of course, what today happens, even 2 degrees of climate change, which we can already be certain of, and actually we're sort of well on route for 3 degrees because we're continuing to gobble up fossil fuels. What you can see in the Little Ice Age is that entire agricultural areas basically migrated, not the people, but the plants, or rather the conditions for the plants. So in the late Middle Ages, wine was grown until the far north of Europe. into England, into Scotland, into Sweden, into Norway, and then that retreated hundreds of kilometers to the south during the Little Ice Age. Now, if you imagine the inverse effect today and you think that agricultural areas around the equator are going to move away from the equator by hundreds of kilometers, that leaves millions and millions of people without sustenance, without a chance to earn their own living, to earn their own keep. And they will have to go somewhere else. Also, rising sea levels up will make coastal peoples very vulnerable. So we were going to have mass migration on a scale that we have never seen. In some way, we will have to learn how to deal with that. And obviously, it's not only unethical, but also impractical to kill people at the border because you want to live a rich and quiet life. So our societies are going to change.
Well, Philip, you've given us an awful lot to think about. I will be mulling over this for quite some time. Thank you for writing your book. It is fascinating. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your excellent questions.
Philip Blom there, author of Nature's Mutiny, How the Little Ice Age of the Long 17th Century Transformed the West and Shaped the Present.
Mick Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.